Good morning. It's Wednesday. It's not Thursday, but this is Thursday Morning Roundtable's 50th anniversary, and we're glad that you're here to help us celebrate. My name is George Kilpatrick. I'm glad to be with you this morning. Well, we want to welcome you to the 50th anniversary of Thursday Morning Roundtable. University College of Syracuse University sponsors Thursday Morning Roundtable, which are conversations that matter. As breakfast is being served, feel free to keep on eating. And we want to thank our sponsors, WCNY-FM, which has taped and broadcast TMR programs for many years, and the Onondaga. Yeah, give it up for them. Yeah. We'd also like to thank the Onondaga Historical Association, which has provided the posters in the back. And there they are. So make sure you have a chance to look at those posters, because those posters share the 50-year history of Thursday Morning Roundtable. At this time, I'd like Sandra Barrett to come forward. Sandra is the Director of Community Programs at Syracuse University. Sandra?
Thank you, George. Welcome, everyone. Welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I have to stop myself from doing my usual shtick, but George Kilpatrick has been a friend of Thursday Morning Roundtable and of our sister organization, the Onondaga Citizens League, for many, many years. As a matter of fact, I was thinking that when we introduced the use of the handheld mic for questions from the audience, and hopefully we will have time for a couple of questions from the audience later today, but anyway, when we did that, which was one of the very few changes that I've ever dared to make at the roundtable in the last 17 years, and if you know that's because change doesn't go over really well. But anyway, George was here. George helped. He handled the mic. And George was the one who taught me to never, ever let go of the microphone. So when you see me gripping it, that's George. He's my mentor. Thank you, George. I think that most of you know a bit about the history of the roundtable. It was started by Lee Smith. He was an assistant dean at University College. He'd come here from the University of Akron, come back here, and he'd run a similar program there. So he put together a planning committee, and the planning committee consisted of a group of men, including Dr. Alex Charters, who's here. Dr. Charters was dean of University College at the time, and then he became a vice president for continuing education at SU. The new dean of SU, and a couple of others, the head of the Metropolitan Development Association, the executive director of the Gifford Charitable Foundation. And what those men envisioned was a weekly civic forum where community leaders would come together to learn about and discuss community issues and problems. And lo and behold, 50 years later, here we are. So what they did was they put together, I'm told, from the history, the definitive history of TMR that Lee wrote before he retired, is they came up with an invitation list. They invited well-known men from all walks of life, government and politics, faith-based organizations, business, social organizations, you name it. And they invited them to the first TMR, which was in March of 1965. And this past March, we celebrated that with a series of programs that kind of mimicked those first four programs in March 50 years ago. So, they would get together regularly. Not all of them, but I think about 30 or 35 of them showed up every week, and they met at the basement snack bar at University College, which was downtown then. And it was actually the Thursday breakfast roundtable, because as I'm told, and some people in the room here can probably verify this, they bought breakfast. So it was Thursday breakfast roundtable, and they met there. Well, over the years, they expanded. They did away with breakfast, because I think they didn't want to eat it, or at least they didn't want to pay for it. So did away with that. So as Alex tells me, it became the only free program in all of the university at the time, Thursday morning roundtable. But there were no women admitted to the roundtable until 1968. And that's when the Human Rights Commission, that was led by a woman at the time, and Karen DeCrow, who was at the time the president of the local chapter of NOW, wrote a series of letters, and you'll see copies of them of this correspondence on one of the posters at the back of the room, and I find it fascinating. So finally, they admitted two women, two city council women, Norma Coburn and Maria Farr, in 1968, and then the very next year, Amelia Greiner joined the roundtable. She was at the time executive director of HomeAids of Central New York. And I think that John Franz, who's sitting next to her up here, was already on the roster. He came in the early days in 66, right. And I think there are a couple of other folks who came in those early days. So again, I think it's so interesting from my perspective. I can remember 1965. And then also, as over the past months, I've looked back over the past 1,661 roundtable programs and the topics. It's kind of interesting to think about the changes that have happened or the changes that haven't happened in those 50 years. But we don't have time to talk about all of that today. Anyway, in his history, Lee Smith said he liked the Reverend Walter Welsh's characterization of TMR as Lee Smith's church in the community. Lee expected that his congregation would be inspired to do good things in the community. Maybe because of my background, I think of TMR more sort of as a graduate course in citizenship and public affairs for people involved in doing good work in the community. And I think that the Onondaga Citizens League, which was started by a group of TMR members back in 1978, that's like an advanced seminar in the program, right? So, you know, right now we're doing an OCL study on community transportation in the community. So that's kind of the take what we've heard at TMR about public transit and transportation and all the rest and study it for a year. There's your advanced seminar. So I think OCL is really one of the important legacies of TMR, along with the scholarship fund that we'll hear more about later. So, but from the start, it was important that it's kind of like a class. It's important that you come to every class, that you attend regularly, because then you get to work in your groups, you get to know the other people that you're working with, and you get a good grade, and you do better work when you're working together, right? But it's also important that you go to class, even if you think you know it all already, or you don't like the guest speaker that they're having that day, because chances are that's when you're going to learn something that's going to help you link together what you've learned in your other classes and your other courses. So to me, that's really, really very important that, you know, you listen even when you think you're not interested. Or today, I guess, maybe our speaker talk about you. Read Charles Bloch's column even when you're a Ross Douthat fan. So you've got to read it all and help you to connect the dots between the issues. So hearing from a variety of sources on a range of topics. That's when we begin to learn, and hopefully we begin to make some progress. And at least that's what I think that Thursday Morning Roundtable is about. I come from, as George did, we were talking a few minutes ago with the mayor, and thank you, Mayor Miner, for being here today, because we both come from public service background. So I think public service, community service go hand in hand. Someone, I think it was Mary Thompson, sent me a link the other day to a TED Talk about Code for America. And there was a quote about how important it is for all of us not just to be politically active, which is important, but also to be bureaucratically active, which I thought was interesting because I've always thought of my, you know, we sometimes denigrate bureaucrats or administrators or doers. You know, we're always talking about leaders and leadership. But I think that being a follower, but being an informed follower, could be just as important as being a leader. Being an informed follower, being a doer. So anyway, I'd like you to hear from what five other people have to say about the roundtable. And these are five people who have been coming to the roundtable regularly for over 40 years. So let's hear what they have to say.
TMR got the imagination of a lot of people.
It's a community forum, but it keeps people aware, it keeps people up to date on what is not necessarily going to appear in the newspaper.
This is a very unusual place where people from government and business, education, you know, all the walks of civic life would come together. And there really still is no one place that you run into that.
It was important to give the community something better than they had before.
The real value of this is having a chance to say hi to somebody face to face.
We've got to start as a learning activity, really, about the community. The fact that these people would come in on a Thursday morning to talk about community issues. And I was one of those people, too, that took a great interest as a learner.
What I really feel now, as I look back, what it was doing was broadening my education about what was going on in the community. I was hearing about things that I had never heard about before. And that really got me interested to the point where I would move appointments around so that I could go to Thursday morning roundtable rather than the appointment.
There is not a session I go to that I don't learn something. And you really can't ask for much more.
So you get some real smiles from doing this work and participating in Thursday morning roundtable.
It was an opportunity to see the civic life of Syracuse and Onondaga County in action.
It was important to give the community something better than they had before.
Great. Thanks, Alex Charters, John Murray, Rick Pettit is here, I know. Marilyn Pinsky, thank you for being interviewed. Sarah McElveen would have been here, but she's out of town today.
Proceeds from today's event benefit Thursday Morning Roundtable Scholarship Fund for students at University College, Syracuse University's home for part-time students. Here to tell us more is Bea Gonzalez. She's the Dean of University College of Syracuse University and the Special Assistant to the Chancellor. B.
Buenos dias.
Buenos dias.
Good morning. So thank you. Here we are at the 50th anniversary of Thursday Morning Roundtable. Do you think Lee thought? So a little story about Lee, right? So when I came to University College in 1984, mere babe was I, and Lee decided that I could go to Thursday Morning Roundtable. And I was like, wow, right? Thursday Morning Roundtable, me. But you couldn't go in there and sit down until everybody that was a member sat down because they almost had their invisible names written on those seats, right? And if you sat in somebody's chair, man, the looks that you got were unbelievable. But anyway, so, you know, let me just say that on behalf of Chancellor Severud, he sends his greetings and his apologies for not being here, but he wants to extend his congratulations on this amazing milestone for Thursday Morning Roundtable. He also wanted me to make sure that I express his thanks to the members, the organizers, the presenters, and the administrators of Thursday Morning Roundtable over these many years, and for our responsibility and our commitment to civic discourse in this community. Now, as you know, Sandra already told us, Levi Smith was the founder. Lee spent 30 years at UC as a devoted leader, advocate, civic and public personality, and one of my personal mentors. When I first came to the university. In 1990, to commemorate the 25th anniversary of TMR, a scholarship was funded and established in honor of Lee and his contributions to higher education. A campaign to raise $25,000 was led by the late Dr. Ernie Saracen and co-chaired by Amelia Greiner, who's still with us today, Amelia. And in just 6 months, they reached their goal. Now, you know how small seeds grow into beautiful packages, right? So since that first scholarship, we've awarded 52 UC students the honor of the Levi Smith Scholarship, right? Six of those students have been awarded the scholarship twice, and 30% of them went on to graduate school. Come on, that deserves... Their majors include liberal studies, child and family studies, education, information management and technology, organizational leadership, neuroscience, and that's just a small sampling of the 52. Now, this morning, some of the recipients of the scholarship are here with us. Would you all please stand, you beautiful bunch of students, and be recognized? Our students will tell you that this award has really made a positive effect on them well beyond their college careers. It's an impact, the impact is more than a financial one. Our students recognize that their accomplishments and hard work is a result of the support that they've gotten from our community through University College and through the scholarship. Let me just give you a little highlight of about a few of them. We're going to talk about four. Frank. Some of you see Frank at Hancock. Frank is working with Homeland Security. He went well in school. Frank completed an internship with the Onondaga County District Attorney's Office, and through that connection was able to obtain a job in Senator DeFrancisco's office. For the past year, Frank has been working with Homeland Security at Hancock, and his goal is to become a member of the Customs and Border Patrol unit. So that's Frank. Paula, where are you? Paula Terrell said that being selected for the Levi Smith Scholarship made it possible for her to realize her dream of earning a bachelor's degree from Syracuse University. It also enabled her to secure her current position at the Synod of the Northeast Ministry. Paula. Shelley, is Shelley here? So Shelley O'Reilly said the scholarship came at a turning point in her college career. She was about to give up the daily struggle of trying to pay for her education, work, and raise her two daughters. But because of the scholarship, Shelley was able to earn her bachelor's degree, and now I know why she's not here. She's now the director of transportation at the Yonkers Public Schools, so that's Shelley. As a young widow, Elaine, where are you? I saw you earlier. Elaine Sartwell chose to go back to school, which meant moving from full-time employment to part-time employment in order to make the commitment to her education. The scholarship enabled her to take a required class toward her bachelor's degree in social work. Elaine is a New York State employee with the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities and works in a group home in Onondaga County. So these are just a few testimonials of from the 52 students that the scholarship has helped to sponsor. So now here's the stuff that I don't do very well, and that's make the pitch, right? So I'm going to make the pitch. For us to endow the scholarship in a way that it would survive through the next 15 years, our goal is to raise, we need to raise about $200,000. What we've done at University College is that for every dollar that TMR has raised, the university has supported with a matching grant. So we will continue to do that. So the more you give, the more SU has to give, right? So here we go. I hope that you take a few moments to meet the students that are here if you get a chance and talk to them and support the scholarship and be generous. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, B. And it is now my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for the day. Charles Blow is a columnist with the New York Times. He's been there since 2008, and he's author of the memoir, Fire, Shut Up in My Bones. And if you haven't picked it up, pick it up, get it. Mr. Blow participated in a fantastic discussion last night with his fellow op-ed columnist, Ross Douthit. In their chat, they talked about social inequality, the how, why, and what to do. It was part of the university lecture series, and we'll follow up with a couple of questions and issues that came up as a result of that conversation last night. But right now, it's our opportunity to have a little dialogue and conversation with Charles Blow.
You don't mind if I bring my coffee?
Bring your coffee. This is a conversation. Hopefully, we'll have some time to get them involved. So let's start with the Democratic debate last night. You were live tweeting very feverishly last night. And one of the tweets that you tweeted was that, not for nothing, and I quote, but Hillary killed it tonight. So give me your thoughts about why you think Hillary killed it. What did we learn about Hillary that we didn't know already, for those of us who liked her, maybe for those of us who don't?
Nothing.
Right.
Okay, so you learned nothing new. I mean, Hillary's been on the scene for what, at least 24 years, maybe longer than that. But that wasn't the point. Her point was not to teach you something new about her, but it was rather to say, I am the person on the stage who is the most presidential and who would be the best. I'm buzzing. It's an alarm. Okay, my kids did that. That dog thing is my kids. They made that. but rather to say I am the best person to go up against the Republican, whoever the Republican nominee eventually is. I think that she had that command of the stage. But you know, part of a debate is presentation. It is theater, and that theatrical part she accomplished very well. Last week, someone would ask me who I thought had the most to gain during the debate. I said Sanders.
Right.
The reason for that was there is what people call Hillary's firewall, which is after the caucuses, then New Hampshire. The debates, the primaries swing south, and you have to. That's where the black people are. That's where the Hispanics are. If you're not, you don't have a base among that group of voters, you're dead. Sanders is not even known by those people. They don't know who that is, and the Clintons have such name ID and such a penetration in that community. That she polls incredibly well. So, in South Carolina, for instance, I think, if you don't put Biden in, I think she is at her approval rating is 84% or something like that. Sanders has to pick up in that group of people. The majority of Democratic primary voters in South Carolina are black people. And when you sweep across the South, black plus Hispanic make up majorities in other states. And if he can't make a dent in that, he has no chance. No matter how good his message is, no matter how much people like him, he has no chance of being the nominee. And so I thought he had a chance to introduce himself to those people. And I do think he took advantage of it. I don't necessarily know if people, it connected in the way that, I'm not sure that people, there's a huge disconnect in between hopes and dreams and what the lives, daily lives that people live. And that, as Baldwin once put it, there is that disconnect. He put this in his essay on Journey to Atlanta. That disconnect is no greater than it is for the Negro. Mm. Yes. That this idea of politicians and promises and what the daily lives of black people is enormous. And they know, black people know that it will be enormous. And so when people hear people saying things that they know will not happen, no matter how good they sound, they already know that half of what you say, even if it could happen, may not happen. But if they hear you say something that is just pie in the sky, there's an incredibly disenchanted eye that is cast onto that person. And I believe that some of that is happening for him, no matter how good it sounds, and it does sound incredibly progressive and it would help, but people don't believe that it can be done.
the kinds of things that he's talking about.
Yes, free college, and free, free. It's like, you know, at a certain point, like people start to think like, Bernie, how much of this free can, I don't know about this free. They don't like free right now, you know? So that becomes, I think, in the back of people's mind, even if they're not consciously processing it as that is what makes some people reticent. I think that makes some people reticent.
What was interesting to me is that Hillary Clinton seemed to be running with Obama, yet at the same time trying to distinguish how she might do it differently. I picked that up as a strategy. Did you?
Well, you have to do that, right? So her, like I said, her firewall is Black and Latino voters. You better be coming to that debate hugged to Obama's ankles. Right? That's what she was doing.
Would that surprise me, though?
It didn't surprise me. And in addition to that, she's telegraphing to Biden, stay home. Mm-hmm. Right?
Despite what CNN wants to do.
I got this. I'm hugging Obama. You can stay home. Like, so she's doing a lot when she's doing that.
Yeah. One of the other questions on the debate that came up was the idea of Black Lives Matter versus All Lives Matter.
Right.
I don't see it as a versus,
right.
But I know that you've written about that. Clarify for all of us why Black Lives Matter.
Versus All Lives Matter?
Or versus, if you want to take it there.
Well, here's the thing. All lives should matter, and what Black Lives Matter is implicitly is that people are saying that Black Lives Matter too. The two is just not attached to the saying, right? It is kind of perfectly, the goal is to have a society in which all lives matter equally. But we don't have that society. And so what these people are saying is that it is in a society where it is obvious that some lives seem to matter less than others, it is not only appropriate, but it is necessary to point out the lives that matter less until they are elevated to the point of all the rest of the lives. And so when people say all lives matter as a way of saying, of dismissing Black Lives Matter, it is to say, we do not register your pain. We will not acknowledge the difference. And that is why they find it so incredibly offensive. Because there is a reality that some people live that is not lived by all. So until America recognizes that all lives matter, it is perfectly legitimate for these people to point to the lives that America values less.
In your memoir, you write of your... Yeah, give it up. Yeah. We're obviously in an environment where there's a conversation about police, community, and several different unarmed African-Americans who were killed in this. You had your own experience. You write about this in your memoir about your experience with law enforcement. Recount that for us quickly, and then what did you take from that, and how does that inform how you view this current debate?
So we are, I can do this shortly, briefly. I was with a bunch of friends, we were off campus, and you know how the South is, maybe you don't know how the South is. So in the South, you have the legacy of segregation, which means basically that everywhere that you have a predominantly white school, somewhere within 3 miles, there's a predominantly Black one. Because those kids were never meant to go to school together. So I went to Grambling State University, 3 miles away, there is Louisiana Tech. And Louisiana Tech is in Ruston, which is kind of predominantly white town. Grambling is in Grambling, which is a Black town. Louisiana Tech has more housing stock, so a lot of kids who went to Grambling would live in Ruston and drive the 3 miles to school. And so we were in Ruston hanging out at one of our friends' apartments. It's a bunch of us, a bunch of boys, about 15 of us. And we're at one apartment, and we all leave. We're going to go back to campus. And we get in how many ever cars that is, caravan of cars. And coming out of the development, there is a kind of a gas station / convenience store. So we go in and we get like kids stuff. So we get like sodas and chips, you know, the kids and hungry. And we get back in the cars, and there's a police cruiser parked out past the gas pumps, and we don't pay any attention, because why would we pay any attention? We're getting chips, and you know. And we all the cars pull out going back to Grambling, and our car, me and my friend, he's driving, I'm in the passenger seat, is the last car out. And I notice that the police cruiser pulls out behind us and starts to follow us. And I let him know, like, hey, they're following us, so he's like trying to drive all best, do his best driving. And the lights come on right before we exit the city limits, because he still has his jurisdiction. And he tells us to pull into the subdivision, the last road to the right. We pull into the subdivision, it's dark. And the guy gets out and he goes, you know, comes to the window, and my friend's like, well, you stop us. And the guy's not having it. He says, show me your license and registration. And he motions to me that it's in the glove box. And I open the glove box, and, you know, so out tumbles what looks like a switchblade. But it's not a switchblade. I don't know if you remember these things at the county fair. You know, like the funds used to have this thing. It's like a switchblade, you pop it, and a cone pops out. You know, so it was like a comb, and I realized immediately, oh, you've been to the fair, you got the comb. Like, I'm not even processing, like, I think it's like funny, like something in my head thinks like this is funny, so I click it so he can see that it's a comb and not a thing. And I click it, and he immediately pulls the gun out. And my hands instinctively go up, and you know, he tells my friend to exit the car, and my friend's still asking, like, so I don't understand, why are you pulling us over? He told us, like, we turned without signaling, but there's no turns. Like, we came out of the thing. So the only turn we turned was you told us to pull over to the side. And then he says, I kind of out of nowhere, like, because my friend is kind of protesting, and he says, I can do what I want. I can make you lay down in the middle of the street, shoot you in the back of the head. Nobody asked me any questions. And we're like, what? You know, like, and he gets back in his car and he just drives away. And we go back to campus. My friend's father was a professor there, and we're just irate because we can't understand it. Like, I'm the freshman class president. He's the freshman class vice president. We're both on scholarships. We're like, we're the good people. What are you talking about? You can't be talking to us. And so we're like just irate when we go into his dad's house, and the dad's like, are you okay? And my friend says, yeah. But he said, what are we gonna do? He says, we're not gonna do anything. Mm. And it was clear to me that that is how Black people have survived in that part of the world, is that they did not trouble the water, they did not ruffle the feathers. If you survived, if you were not hurt, you were not going to make a fuss. And I did not like that at all. Hmm. But I had also lived in a bubble in a way. You know, I lived in a predominantly Black town. I went to a Black high school, Black schools, because all the white kids, when Louisiana finally gave in to integration, they also set up these funding for these academies, which were basically like places you could send white kids when you don't want to be around Black people. And so all of the white kids in town were taken out of school and sent to these academies. So the white people were like ghosts to me. I didn't know there were white kids. Every now and then on a Sunday morning, you'd pass by a white church. You'd be like, I saw a white kid, like, you know, because I didn't see them. Mm. Like, and you know, because they were busing so far away, they would leave before we would even wake up, and they'd get back after we had done our commute after school. So we never saw them. And, you know, and so I didn't see that. And the only cop in town we had one cop. He was my cousin. So I didn't know to be afraid of police. because the, you know, that's my cousin. Like, the cop's not gonna hurt anybody, it's my cousin. So I didn't have it built into me that don't press that button, the cops are afraid of you, cops are something one for you to be afraid of. It just didn't exist in me.
So quickly on that, so today now, looking back at that experience, how do we contextualize what is happening today based on your experience and many other people in this room probably have had, some other people in this room have had some kind of encounter?
Well, what I always say is that I don't know an adult black man who has no encounter. Which is the travesty. Does not say anything about each individual officer, which I know many great people, but it only takes one. You know, I can recount that one from 25 years ago like it was yesterday.
Yeah.
It only takes one to scar you. And then when you go to the barbershop and you can mention that and every single person in there can give you one that can one up the last one, it's a problem.
Let me ask, shift topics real quick. Paul Drygalski, the Rutgers University Camden professor, recently published a study called The Architecture of Segregation, which says that Syracuse has the highest extreme poverty concentrated among blacks and Hispanics or Latinos in the nation's 100 largest metropolitan areas, trying to say it the way it's supposed to be said, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you said that it's not the ability or the desire, but the design of a city and the allocated funds that contribute to the issue of extreme poverty among these issues. So if it's the design of it, how to redesign cities such that we don't have these extreme concentrations of poverty, or can we do that?
Well, I mean, first thing you have to understand is that concentrated poverty exists by design, and that happened over centuries, and that you may spend centuries dismantling that poverty. There is no, when people say, what is the solution? They're really asking for a, what is it? How do we fix this tomorrow? How do we fix this so that in the next 5 years we won't have it? And I say to people, it took 200 years to create the ghetto as you understand it. By housing policy, by the urban planning of cities and making sure that we use taxpayer dollars to build roads to places where poor people could not go and that banks would not loan them money to go, right? Where we redlined particular neighborhoods that prevented them from even being, if you lived in there, you could even qualify for a mortgage. The stepping stone, the GI Bill that many veterans used after World War II as a stepping stone into the middle class that was denied to vast majorities of black veterans who also fought for this country. This happens over centuries of design on every level. It's not a Syracuse problem. The federal government was participating in this all the way down to the local governments were participating in this. And then on top of that, individual biases were coming into play. So you have to look at it and say, how do we, over the next 200 years, dismantle what we have built? And I think if you look at it with a longer lens and a longer horizon, you get closer to understanding both the scope and scale of the problem, but also to knowing that we can make incremental changes that will dismantle certain parts over certain periods of time. But nothing should be judged as if it is a silver bullet that solves something in the next decade.
We want to fix now.
Yeah, I know, but that's not the way it's going to happen,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because you have centuries of oppression and bias that has created this situation. And people, and what we have to stop having conversations about is, you know, is pathologies and choice. Black people, Hispanic, didn't just one day say, you know what, I know where I want to live. I want to live in that high crime, high poverty neighborhood because it is lovely over there. No, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. That is not how that worked. Black people didn't say, wake up one morning and say, you know what, I want to get things and not work at all. And no, what the data say, you know, the welfare queens mythology that was part of our kind of discussion over the last 20 years, starting with Reagan, no, what the data say, this is federal data, is that black women were much more likely than white women to work. That's what the historical data say. That when white women were at home baking cookies and taking care of families, black women were cleaning those houses, mm-hmm. right? They have been working. We have to stop pathologizing that what's happened in those areas and saying, this is a result of simple choices that you have made that have nothing to do with us, because that is a lie. It's a historical lie. It is a historical lie meant to make us feel good, to make us believe that the advantages that we have nothing to do with the disadvantages that our ancestors created for other people.
We're talking about privilege now.
I'm talking about privilege and oppression, because they are like a seesaw. Your privilege is built on my oppression. There is no way to discuss privilege without discussing oppression.
Do we have a question out here? Give it up. No, that, yeah, please. While we're looking for a question here, what did you think happened? What did you accomplish last night with Ross Douthat? Do you think you moved the conversation forward?
Oh, I don't know. First of all, I like Ross. Like, I always call him, like, I'm like, you're my favorite conservative. Because, you know, I do believe, like, smart people, regardless of where you are on the spectrum, you can have an intelligent conversation. And he's really smart about, you know, contextualizing things. And, you know, and there is...
Is he right?
He's right on some things, okay. You know. I'm right on some things, too. I think sometimes in this kind of hyper-polarized environment, we sometimes forget the William Buckleys of the world, that the kind of really intelligent conservatism that used to exist in America that has given way to the front runner. I'm not even going to say his name now.
Well, right? There's a tie now.
Almost. Right. But people who, the anti-intellectualism that people seem to crave on that side of the spectrum. But that's not the conservatism I knew as a kid. That there were real conservative intellectuals that had incredible ideas, and you might not have agreed with their strategies or whatever, but it was smart. And I think Ross comes out of that kind of pantheon of thinkers. And I love having a conversation with him, because it challenges me to think a little bit more deeply.
Couple questions.
All right. We'll let Fred take one. He's a journalist.
Yeah, a few years ago, Occupy Wall Street seemed to really raise up and clarify the issue of income inequality, like the 99% and the 1%. Bernie Sanders seems to be having his moment now of really refocusing on that issue, which seemed to go away. And my question is, do you really think Hillary Clinton, who I like a lot, could be a standard bearer for that issue, given her contributions from Wall Street and hedge fund managers and her apparently being kind of captivated by finances?
Listen, I think one of the things that Bernie says that is true, is legitimately true, is he's one of the only candidates that's not part of the cesspool of money in Washington. Everybody in Washington, post-Washington, even particularly post-Washington, they go, they make a little bit of money. They leave, they make a ton of money. And so all politicians are rich. This is what we don't quite understand. I don't think the average voter quite gets how many millionaires there are in Congress. And so that's a very real disconnect, regardless of who you are, which party you're in. And in fact, some of the richest people in Congress are not Republicans, but Democrats. That said, you know, the income inequality message, I think, is really interesting and tricky because it ends up being, it overlaps with the racial ethnic issues in a very bizarre way. Meaning that it affects everyone equally, but how you prioritize the biggest threat to you is different based on who you are, right? How you prioritize is the biggest blow to your abilities to advance in the world are different based on who you are. All of these things may be true to you, but you may prioritize one above the other. Occupy Wall Street was one of those things that was remarkable for how white it was. Even though that is an issue that everybody should have been able to connect with, some people are like, well, we've always had income inequality, but now you have $80,000 in college loans because you majored in art appreciation and Christie's won't hire you and now you're mad and sleeping in a tent, right? So that became like young white people who went to fancy schools anger, right? And it didn't quite connect across racial, ethnic boundaries. And that is, I think, what Bernie's issue has become. He keeps saying, the billionaire class and us against the billionaire class and us against the billionaire class. And there are a lot of people who are just like, that's y'all. There are two black billionaires in America, Oprah and Michael Jordan, and we kind of like them, right? So it's not really connecting in the way that it could if you brought the lens down and not talk about my separation between the guy with a billion, but my separation between the person who's basically doing the same thing that I'm doing, and we have very different outcomes in our lives. And I think that bringing that down to this, that kind of a separation and talking about how do I simply make a better life for myself from where I start becomes a more relatable message. Income inequality can be like, you know, this, you know, I'm gonna throw 500 numbers at you, and, you know, if you are into math, this is gonna make you feel really good and really smart and really, you know, like this is a social justice moment. And there are people out here who say, we are deporting more of people who look like me than ever before, and that, I'm gonna prioritize that for me. And there are other people who are saying, I keep seeing black bodies falling in front of police officers, and I'm gonna prioritize that for me. People are just prioritizing different things, even though all of these things matter to them. And so the income inequality message doesn't always, because there is not a similar trauma in the white community to mass deportation or immigration issue or mass incarceration in the black community and violence, that I can understand why that would be like, that is my highest issue. Like, I want to know why he made a billion, and I get that. But it's different across racial groups.
Can you connect that, Charles, to what I think it was a week or two ago that Paul Thoreau wrote about his travels through the Deep South? And he was picking on philanthropists and the fact that all of these folks who made their millions and billions on Wall Street in the financial markets, but also in Silicon Valley, then are, you know, whoa, giving their billions to, you know, oh, well, charity, as opposed to why don't they, this is Paul Thoreau's argument, why don't they just bring those jobs back that they sent off to the markets where the labor costs are negligible, where they made all the money, you know, making those cheap chips and sandals and things. Does that resonate with you at all? Again, it's not a racial issue, but it's an income equality argument.
Well, I mean, we understand that philanthropy is always just a tiny fraction of what you have, right? bring jobs back, change the way I do business, can be a big part of what I have, right? It can put a big dent in my bottom line and in my wealth. So I think, you know, philanthropy is always interesting to me and how, what rich people do to feel good about being rich. You know, I have been to, I can't tell you how many fundraisers I've been to in somebody's, like, grotesquely ornate New York City house that cost probably more than I can ever make in a lifetime. And they're holding a fundraiser for some reading program in Harlem, you know? And it's kind of funny to me because I'm like, actually, there's something odd about this. And they, you know, at the end of the evening, they get up and say, we raised $10,000, you know? Like, I'm like, what are you talking about? This is, we're in a $50 million house. Like, you, that's a rounding error. Like, this doesn't make any sense. I don't understand. It doesn't make sense to me what's happening with the, but it's, but I think people need to feel good about it, about being that wealthy, because they know that it is an uncomfortable situation. So they insulate themselves from actually having to deal with real poverty, and they try to alleviate some around the edge, deal with issues of it around the edges, and whenever it comes into their space, so that you go to a, you know, yes, you do go to the charity auction, and you, and they, you know, they say, well, who can give $5,000? You raise your hand, and everybody claps, whoo, you know, like, and actually, that's nothing for you. I once sat across the from the CEO of Macy's, and he was, and he wrote a check. We gotta write a check for so and so. And I was like, you have a lot of checks to write. It was such a small check, but in that for him, but in that place, it felt huge. So I do believe there's a weird thing that happens because, in fact, all rich people want to stay rich. Don't get that twisted. Nobody's really trying, because to solve it, to solve the income inequality thing means that it's a zero-sum game. I have to have less of it for somebody else to have more of it. I don't want you to really have more of it. I want to have exactly how much I have, but how can we make you have more? Can we just get more pies to add to the pie? Because I don't want to divide the pie. Right? That's always the conservative argument. We want to grow the pie. Right? We don't want it to be redivided. So, but it doesn't really work that way. So I think people want the status quo to be maintained, particularly if you are part of one of the people who are benefiting from the status quo. So nobody's bringing back any jobs. They'll do a little philanthropy because it's going to make them feel better about the fact that they do not want to upset what has made them incredibly wealthy. And that's, I think, a kind of a human nature issue.
Where are we on time, Sandra?
We are 9 o'clock, and I know that Mr. Blow's ride is waiting for him. I'm sorry. Okay. I know. So thank you,
please give
Charles
it up for Charles Blow. New York Times, CNN, and the book is Fire Shut Up in My Bones. Thank you so much.
Right. Thank you. And thank you, George Kilpatrick.
Thank you.
All right. And I wanted to thank all of you. There's no Thursday morning roundtable tomorrow, just so that you know. But I also want to thank Barbara Stripling, who accompanied Charles Blow here. He was here, as you know, last night for a lecture through the University Lecture Series. So I want to thank my friends at the University Lecture Series, Esther Gray in particular, for helping to make us these arrangements, albeit on a Wednesday morning. And I think another round of applause for the Levi L. Smith Scholarship recipients. Bravo. And the good work, because we are all about continuing education. So again, thank you for helping us to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Thursday Morning Roundtable, especially those of you, the one of you who's been here for 50 years, Alex, and all of you who've been through it, and all of you who also are friends at WCNY who have broadcast us every week for a long, long time. And there are always more questions. There's always more to learn. And so keep at it. Thank you very, very much.